ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Should you defy the law to defend your religious principles? A lawyer weaves his way through this minefield on the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. First, King Charles visits the Vatican this week. It's not just a meet and greet, though, between two heads of state. For the first time in 500 years, the Pope and a monarch who's also Supreme Governor of the Church of England will pray together publicly. Luke Coppen is UK editor of The Pillar, a website that covers the Catholic world.
King Charles is going to undertake a state visit to Vatican City. This is notable for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that this is a visit only to the Vatican rather than the Vatican and Italy, which is often how such visits are conducted. So this is a trip that's truly focused on relations between the British monarchy and the Catholic Church. King Charles will pray together with Pope Leo at a service in the Sistine Chapel. And this is being billed as the first time that a British monarch has prayed alongside a pope since the Reformation. This is a very important moment in relations between the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church, because King Charles III is the supreme governor of the Church of England. This isn't merely two heads of state meeting, it's also has a strong religious dimension as well.
Yeah, and on that, Luke, this may seem a minor point to some, but I think it's freighted with significance. Correct me if I'm wrong, but is it true that they will actually kneel together in prayer? It won't just be Charles and Camilla, you know, sitting in the front row praying with the rest of the crowd.
I don't know about kneeling for sure, although that is the customary posture for a pope to be praying. So it wouldn't surprise me if they were kneeling together. So it's being presented as the first time they've prayed together side by side. This is a sort of specially dedicated public prayer event in which it will be clear that the two men are praying together, completely explicit, that that's the purpose of it. As it hasn't happened before, it is truly a historic event.
Yeah. Do we know why this joint prayer service is happening now?
I believe that it was supposed to be part of a trip that was intended to take place earlier in the year when King Charles III was going to visit Pope Francis on a state visit. Unfortunately, because of Pope Francis's illness, the state visit was cancelled, although King Charles III then made a private visit with Queen Camilla to Pope Francis as he was very ill in April. So I think the joint prayer was supposed to be part of the earlier state visit that was cancelled. And now it's going ahead with Pope Leo.
Yeah, I guess the point is, Luke, the late Queen met, I think, most of the popes whose papacies coincided with her reign, but it never went this far. What's the difference?
I do think that the difference lies in the common prayer, because, as you mentioned, on the other occasions, the state visits of Queen Elizabeth II to the Vatican were more diplomatic occasions, more focused on her role as head of state in the UK rather than as the supreme governor of the Church of England. So I think this trip is explicitly recognising King Charles III's spiritual role as the supreme governor of the Church of England. That's a notable difference and a sign of how far ecumenical relations between Catholics and Anglicans have progressed in the last 50 years or so.
Yeah. Well, speaking of ecumenical relations, did I read, Luke, even the head of the Presbyterian Church, the Church of Scotland, is going to take part in this prayer service? Extraordinary, given that once upon a time, the Presbyterians had as part of their founding documents the statement that the Pope is, quote, the Antichrist.
Yes, I mean, their presence will certainly raise eyebrows at this event. It does recall for me an event that happened earlier in this year in which King Charles III asked a Catholic to represent him at a meeting of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. This was the first time in history, that this had happened, and actually required a change in the law in the UK to allow a Catholic to represent King Charles as his delegate to this body in Scotland.
Now, the prayers that will be said in the Sistine Chapel reflect, I guess you could say, a shared set of interests. Maybe you could call them a shared set of values that the King and the Pope hold. What are these themes? What will be at the centre of these prayers, Luke?
So I think they're focusing on two topics. One, ecumenism, so relations between different Christian communions and the search for Christian unity. And the second is care of creation, so sensitivity to the environment and the Christian commitment to taking care of God's creation. Those are going to be the central themes. And both men have a track record of caring very deeply about the environment. Pope Leo is recently the first person to celebrate a new mass that's for the care of creation, has a special kind of intention behind it. King Charles, as we know, has a long history of environmental activism and support for environmental projects around the world.
It's not just this joint prayer service with the Pope. What's this honour, a Catholic honour, that's being bestowed on Charles, remembering that he's the supreme governor of a church that was once considered a heresy?
After he takes part in the event at the Sistine Chapel, he's going to go to the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. This is one of the four papal basilicas, the four great papal churches of Rome. There, he's going to be given a special title of Royal Confrater, and he's going to be given his own chair inside the basilica as well. The title and the chair are a great honour, being given with permission of Pope Leo to King Charles. And that's in recognition of the deep historical connections between the basilica and the British royal family. Before the Reformation, British monarchs were great benefactors of the basilica, and they helped with this upkeep. This is a kind of rekindling of that ancient tie between the monarch and the basilica.
And I think he's even got his own chair that's been especially made with the coat of arms of the British monarch.
Yes, and it's interesting that when this was presented, they said this would be both for King Charles III and his successors. So there's a long-term view here that there will be an ongoing relationship in the future between the British monarch and the papal basilica. And whenever the monarch visits Rome, they go and sit in that chair and maybe attend a service. That is a very far-sighted way of reconnecting the Catholic Church with the British monarchy.
Speaking of far-sighted, how much of this, and this doesn't in any way dismiss Charles's genuine interest in interfaith relations, but how much of this is also pragmatic, given that the Catholic Church, I think, now has more weekly or monthly church attendees than Anglicanism in the United Kingdom? I mean, how much is this Charles recognising that with immigration, Britain is becoming not a Catholic country, but certainly a country with a stronger Catholic presence?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's definitely present in his mind. And all these gestures go down very, very well with English Catholics, so they're greatly appreciated. I think the esteem for English Catholics in general, for King Charles III, is very high at this point. And he's seen as someone who kind of gets what Catholics, British Catholics, are about, and that they're not any threat to the British state as they were once portrayed. And he's done a great deal to encourage that. For example, attending events at Westminster Cathedral, the home of English Catholics, and speaking out on behalf of persecuted Christians around the world. These are things that have been noted by Catholics.
Luke Coppen of The Pillar. You're on ABC Radio National, hearing about the links between religion and the news that shapes the world. Fiji is facing an HIV crisis. The number of cases has more than tripled in the past 6 years. The Uniting Church in Australia is working with local health agencies. Alice Salomon is head of advocacy. She's just back from the capital, Suva. Alice, welcome. Just how serious is the problem?
It's the fastest growing rate of HIV infection in the world in Fiji. So we have seen a doubling of infection rates, and it's predicted to hit about 25,000 over the next 4 years if nothing is done.
25,000. This is a country with fewer than a million residents.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a really significant proportion of people who are going to be impacted by this.
Yeah. What's driving the increased rate of HIV in Fiji?
So the biggest driver of HIV infection is amongst the community of people who inject drugs. So we're seeing nearly half of the rates of infection coming from people who inject drugs.
I mean, what sort of drugs are we talking about?
Methamphetamine is the most common drug that's being used in Fiji. Just to be clear, injecting drugs in and of itself or using drugs doesn't actually lead to HIV infection. It's the sharing of syringes that's really the problem right now, a scarcity of syringes that's leading to the increase in HIV.
There is a social taboo, though, against using drugs in Fiji and in many places of the world. I mean, we're not minimising the dangers of the use of the drugs, though.
We see that stigma as a worldwide issue. It's certainly the reason that the Uniting Church and Uniting New South Wales ACT have been really active in the space of harm reduction. So we see the stigma around drug use really driving a lack of access to the kinds of services that save lives.
Right. But the aim is not to make drug use acceptable, though, in places like Fiji. The aim is to stem HIV infection.
That's right. We want to have a look at what are the strategies and the harm reduction strategies that really work in reducing HIV infection rates. We can see what's happening in Fiji is tied to injecting drug use. Introducing services like needle syringe programs can really help stem the tide of infection.
Tell me about this process whereby drugs are reinjected or blood is reinjected. This seems unbelievably risky, something that I had never heard of, but it seems to be the driver of this.
So this is really interesting, this concept of Bluetoothing, which I hadn't heard of before, and it's gotten a lot of coverage in the media. So the concept of Bluetoothing is taking the blood of somebody who's recently injected drugs and using that to inject drugs yourself. What's really interesting, Kirby did a rapid study about the patterns of injecting drug use.
This is the Kirby Institute.
Right. They found no cases of this process of Bluetoothing. And that probably tracks as accurate because it wouldn't work. Taking the blood of someone who's injected drugs wouldn't lead you to experience the effect of the drug. So we think this is something that maybe has been reported or maybe been heard of, but has been really latched onto because it's the most kind of dramatic way of talking about what's happening. What's really leading to the spike in HIV infection is the scarcity of clean injecting equipment in Fiji.
What's the solution to that? Because the government in Fiji, obviously very concerned about the spread of HIV, but once again, going back to the social mores of the country, I don't imagine they would be keen to encourage or validate this use. So what's the solution?
This is a complex issue. We can see in Fiji there is a lot of stigma around people who are injecting drugs. And so part of the challenge really is about how does a country introduce a harm reduction program that will lead to the containing of the HIV infection rates that's happening, but in a way that is in step with the community. And that is part of the reason why we were there as the Uniting Church, is to engage in that conversation with faith leaders. About 98% of Fiji belong to a faith organisation. Uniting Church is partnered with the Fijian Methodist Church. And so we were there to have a conversation with faith leaders about the real need to save lives and how programs that are harm reduction focused, like needle syringe programs, can do that, and how we grappled with that as a faith organisation.
Yeah. What role do the religious leaders in Fiji, and as you say, it's a 98%, it was not a 98% Christian country, but it's a 98% country of faith. What do you envisage their role would be?
So the evidence shows that if you use needle syringe programs, you can contain HIV outbreaks. We know that from our experience in Australia, which we introduced needle syringe programs in 1987. We have the lowest rates of HIV infection in the world among the people who inject drugs. So the evidence and the science is there. Really, the conversation needs to be with communities about why these programs are important and how they work. And so faith leaders play a really critical role in being able to engage with their communities, but also to be able to support the theological understanding of why do we do these harm reduction services? Why are these important? Why is saving lives important? We certainly had to go through that wrestle ourselves. Where do we stand on the issue of drugs? as a church and where do we stand on the issue of harm reduction and what are our kind of theological underpinnings for that? And that's really the role faith leaders can play as being super connected to their communities, having that kind of moral authority and being able to look pragmatically across what the epidemic is actually showing up as in Fiji.
Yeah, but if faith leaders indicated a willingness to advise people to use clean syringes, or is their preference to say don't use?
The conversations that we were having with people across the faith communities were really around not being an either or. So you can hold that you would prefer that people weren't injecting drugs and you can support pathways to treatment and those kind of things, whilst also dealing with the problem that's right in front of you, which is this rapidly increasing HIV infection. Our conversations have been really warm and pragmatic, I think, in the way that people have been wrestling through these two things. They're not mutually exclusive. You can actually take those steps to save lives. And I think, you know, what we've learnt from our experience in Australia is how important these harm reduction services are in bringing people who have been cast out into the shadows back into the light, back into connection with people. And that's something that faith leaders really see a role for themselves in.
Yeah, and that's a really important point, Alice. What happens to people who inject these drugs? What happens to them socially?
We can see across the world, but also in Fiji, that people who inject drugs are really on the margins of society. They're very much in the shadows. And we see the role of stigma and shame and fear really contributing to how people are driven away. Through that, people become disconnected from the sorts of services that can save lives. So a needle syringe program can bring people back into connection. They can experience what it's like to be welcomed into a space without judgment, and they can get really good information about how to inject drugs safely and in a way that isn't going to spread bloodborne viruses. That issue of stigma and shame is really been the biggest barrier to getting access to the sorts of harm reduction services that save lives.
Alice Salomon, she's the head of advocacy for Uniting. Thanks for being with us on the program, Alice.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're with me, Andrew West. How can Christians and other religious believers live their faith when its principles conflict not only with new social norms, but the laws of the land? Patrick Parkinson was Dean of the Queensland University Law School. He's also an internationally recognised expert on child protection. He tries to find a way through in his new book, Unshaken Allegiance.
I don't think there's alarm, Andrew, but there is an increasingly difficult situation. And it's not about going to church on Sunday or going to the synagogue on Saturday. It's not about that. It's about how we run Christian organisations, how we navigate difficult issues in public policy. We are increasingly experiencing a more hostile legal environment than we are used to, with a lot of religious freedoms being curtailed, for example, for Christian schools and organisations.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work on the persecution of Christians in places like Syria and Iraq, Pakistan, China, Egypt. For many Christians in those countries, their life is literally at risk every day to live their faith.
You cannot possibly make any comparisons with the experience of Christians in those countries. That said, it's just a more difficult environment for many Christians than it was. And you can tell that by asking people, do you feel comfortable talking about your faith at work? Now, we're meant to bring our whole selves to work, right? But I don't think you can bring your whole self to work as a committed Christian. You may find it very difficult. You may find a lot of opposition to it. These are the sorts of pressures that people are experiencing. They're increasingly feeling they need to be silent believers, at least in the workplace. And they can be on the wrong end of lawsuits and hate speech laws and this kind of thing. It's just a more precarious situation than it was 20 years ago.
You make this interesting argument that Australia and the UK have not necessarily passed anti-religious laws, but there are other laws that are used against them. What are you talking about there? Because I find that fascinating.
Well, it's a very important point that law is increasingly being weaponized for political reasons by activists of various kinds. These laws are not aimed at Christians as such. I'll give you an example. Tasmania, you can make a complaint under the Anti-Discrimination Act if something offends you on the basis of all sorts of things, disability, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, and so on and so forth. These are not aimed at Christians, but Christians can find themselves caught in the crossfire of activist-inspired complaints, as the Catholic Archbishop of Hobart did some years ago.
And in that case, though, the complaint petered out. I mean, this is, I guess, part of the complication here. I don't know whether the complaint was described or came to be dismissed as vexatious, but it really went nowhere. It took up a lot of the Archbishop's time, but in the end, it sort of went nowhere, did it?
This is very frequently the case. The punishment is the process. It's having to engage with mediation or something of that kind. The criticism I would make is not of the complainant. They're entitled to make their complaint. My criticism is of the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner in that case, who accepted that complaint and said, yes, it could be a valid complaint under Tasmanian law. And it was simply a complaint about the Catholic Bishops' Conference booklet on why marriage should remain between people of opposite sexes.
But someone took offence. The point is someone took offence. Do people have the right not to be offended?
They really don't. And if once you start saying that people have the right not to be offended, it's a weapon to suppress debate on important issues. From a Christian point of view, you should never go out deliberately to offend somebody, to cause them upset. We should be reasonable, we should be respectful, we should be caring in all that we do and say, but we can be caught up in the crossfire.
You've had a very successful career. You were a senior academic at the University of Sydney, which is where I first met you. You then became the dean of the law faculty at the University of Queensland. If I recall correctly, Patrick, you were a consultant to the Royal Commission into Institutional Sexual Abuse, which recognised your extensive commitment on child protection. Now, I would say that you are someone I'd call a small-c conservative Christian. Have you hit turbulence personally in your career because of your faith?
Absolutely, I have. And I say a little bit about that in the book. I don't say much, but I found myself facing significant opposition at the University of Sydney, specifically because of my public faith. I applied for a senior job. There was a great campaign against me. One of the members of the appointments committee at the time said, Patrick, we all know you're a Christian. Just don't talk about it. Nobody worries about what I do on Sunday. Nobody worries about me going to church. Nobody worries about me having a faith. But if I share that, if that's part of my public identity, if it's part of my work, that's where problems can come. So, yes, I've experienced turbulence and a lot of other people have as well.
Mm. I suppose this goes to the point that we were talking about earlier, though, hitting turbulence, as it were, and falling victim to anti-Christian prejudice are very different things. I mean, you give many examples, concrete examples of what you might call anti-Christian discrimination. What are they?
There are several that are very well known in Australia. The Andrew Thorburn case, a businessman, had been CEO, I think, of the National Australia Bank, gets appointed as CEO of Essendon Football Club. And within 24 hours, there's a campaign to remove him. Why? Because he's chair of a particular church board which has conservative views. We don't even know what his own views were, only his association. He was drummed out with pressure coming from the Premier of Victoria himself. Sometimes the law stands behind you in these things. I believe in Andrew Thorburn's case that he did reach a settlement with Essendon about that. I think the discrimination against him was very clear.
Yeah, well, in the Andrew Thorburn case, I mean, this, I guess, illustrates my point. Andrew Thorburn not only won, as I understand it, compensation himself, he got a public apology from Essendon. Essendon then had to donate a considerable amount of money to a charity of Andrew Thorburn's choosing, and I think some of the Essendon leadership ended up resigning. So the law wasn't against him. I mean, the law actually does protect religious freedom, doesn't it?
At times it does, and that's one of the points I make in the book. We face a more difficult legal situation, but sometimes the law is on our side, and sometimes we need to insist upon our legal rights in these situations.
Let's talk now about some of the red flags, though. And I want to raise an example that you give involving schools. And it's not actually the question of the gay teacher, because that comes up a lot. And I think you'd acknowledge there are probably thousands of gay teachers working very discreetly and harmoniously in Christian schools. What about, though, the case of a teacher who might, in her or his private time, run an OnlyFans website? OnlyFans being a place where people put not exclusively, but often pornographic content that they've produced themselves. What would happen in that circumstance?
That is an example I give in the book. Queensland introduced new reforms to its anti-discrimination laws last year, and it made sex work a protected attribute. What that means is that you can make a complaint under the anti-discrimination law. You can seek compensation if you have been discriminated on the basis of your engagement in sex work. Now, specifically, that definition in the Act would cover OnlyFans, because it covers online content of that kind. Now, imagine that a teacher, female teacher, let's say, was engaged in her private life on OnlyFans. Some of the kids at school got hold of some photographs, began circulating them throughout the student body. You can imagine that a principal of a school in that situation would be horrified, would want to take firm action. They would not be able to do so under Queensland law without breaching anti-discrimination law. And unfortunately, the Christian school wouldn't be in a much better position than the state school principal. Why? Because it's only got an exemption if the behaviour is in the course of that teacher's work. You would think that what they do in their private time at evenings or weekends is not related to their schoolwork. So this is an example of where anti-discrimination law has covered more and more of life and has given fewer and fewer exemptions to people of faith on moral issues of that kind.
Now, your book, Unshaken Allegiance, raises the question of whether Christians and other people of faith should defy laws that violate their consciences. Should they defy those laws?
A lot of what I say in the book is to recognize the importance of law and the rule of law, the importance of obeying the law, the importance of having governments which are effective. Nobody wants to live in a lawless society, Andrew. Nobody wants to live in a failed state. The context of what I have to say in the book is that we are urged by St. Paul to respect government, to obey the law, but there are limits to that. Now, it's not just about personal conscience. I think that's too expansive a view, because what we have seen is some Christians getting into terrible trouble because they've held a personal view which is not widely shared in the Christian community. I give the example of the Queensland group who let a child die because they believed that the Lord would heal this girl. The Lord didn't heal her, she died. That was not a widely shared belief in the Christian community.
So, especially not with you, a noted child protection advocate, I should say.
Indeed. But there are boundaries. If the law interferes with our private spiritual lives, our capacity to practice our faith, we're not bound to obey. If it stops us preaching what we believe, in principle, we shouldn't feel bound by that law. Yeah. These are the sorts of laws you have in communist China, you have in Eastern Europe under the Soviet era and so on. No, we don't have an obligation to obey such laws. We must be very discerning about when we disobey and how we disobey.
Professor Patrick Parkinson, his book is called Unshaken Allegiance. There's a longer version of that chat when you go to our website or follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for this episode. A big thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.